Hi, Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you are about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll listen to the first part of a two-part broadcast of Recognized, a special series from the Vermont Public Podcast, Brave Little State. It's about Abenaki peoples and the ongoing dispute about who belongs to their communities. We'll be broadcasting this on Vermont Edition over 2 days. The shows cover sensitive material, including some slurs, so please listen with care. Reporter Elodie Reed and senior producer Josh Crane take it from here.
From Vermont Public and the NPR Network, this is Brave Little State. I'm Josh Crane.
And I'm Elodie Reed. For the past 20 years, there's been this controversy in Vermont. But for most of that time, it's felt sort of hush-hush. Many people don't really like talking about it. Some would rather avoid acknowledging it's there in the first place. But in the last couple years, it's gotten harder to ignore. More and more people have been speaking out.
Her grandfather is in the picture.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is. Her grandfather is in the picture.
One afternoon this spring, a dozen people form a circle in a dusty parking lot, hunched against a chilly breeze.
It's cold.
So what is the plan?
It snowed in the... at home this morning.
They're standing outside the Ethan Allen Homestead Museum in Burlington. Ethan Allen is a celebrated figure in Vermont's colonial history, or not so celebrated.
The Allens, they were the lead family who, like, essentially surveyed most of the land in Vermont and, like, acquired it and then resold it.
So more land grabbers?
I mean, he's the number one land grabber, yeah.
Most of the people gathered in this parking lot drove down from Canada or up from Albany, New York. But they're not actually here to take issue with Ethan Allen. They're here to protest an exhibit inside the building called The Abenaki, Vermont's First People. It was curated by a Vermont nonprofit, Al Nabaiwi, which says it's dedicated to preserving Vermont Abenaki heritage. And here's one more twist. These protesters, here to take a stand against a history exhibit dedicated to Abenaki heritage, they're Abenaki. Okay.
We all came from Odenek just to make sure that we can see what's going on and see if we can't get our voices heard.
If you live in Vermont, you've probably heard of the Abenaki. They're the original caretakers of the land now known as Vermont and New Hampshire, and also Quebec, Maine, and Massachusetts. The groups you're probably most familiar with are those that have been recognized by our state as Abenaki tribes. What you might not know is that there are Abenaki First Nations north of the border, in Canada. They have a very different type of recognition, federal recognition, from the Canadian government. They're called Odenak First Nation and Woolyneck First Nation. Both nations are headquartered in Quebec, and they're both Western Abenaki. By the way, some people say it Abenaki with a French pronunciation. We're using the more anglicized Abenaki.
That's the incompetence of this museum.
Today, gathered in the Ethan Allen Homestead Museum parking lot, are citizens and allies of Odenak.
Because it's family. Family is so important, and cultural appropriation is a serious matter. And,
the thing they're here to protest is the use of a single photograph in this Abenaki history exhibit. It's from a 1906 postcard, which is captioned with the words, Indian Camp, Highgate Springs, Vermont. It has been enlarged and printed on a wall of the exhibit. The photo is black and white. It shows women and children in the background, standing by the door of a cabin. In the foreground, a man in a hat holds a pan over a fire. And who that man is, and who he's related to, are the main points of contention. On one side are the Odenak First Nation government and some of its citizens, saying the man in the image is related to the Panadies, a well-established Abenaki family. On the other, you have the Vermont nonprofit Al Nabaiwi, saying the man in the image is related to one of the curators of the exhibit, Holly LaFrance. She belongs to one of the groups that the state of Vermont recognizes as Abenaki.
And then they're claiming, you know, Holly LaFrance in front of a their family photo, saying that she's related. That's my ancestor. It's a joke.
LaFrance isn't here on this chilly spring day, and she has declined to be interviewed. Instead, volunteers from Al Nubaiwi wander out from the museum and into the parking lot, where Odinak citizens and some allies are circled up. Within seconds, the arguing begins.
Who are you, sir? Who are you?
Brett. What I am here to say is Holly has a picture of her grandfather in that picture. So you have basically proven that Holly is related to the Pennedy.
Didn't prove anything.
Thanks.
She won't respond. This is all the Pennedy family. So you tell me, they see that.
Good. She is related to the Pennedys then.
Oh, no. This is her genealogy. Where do you see a family name in there?
We
go back four generations.
It's not clear yet. But her grandfather,
then don't stand in front of
their photo. Her grandfather is in the picture.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is. Her grandfather is in the picture.
Yeah, well, okay.
There's no way for me to say with 100% certainty who the man in this century-old photo is. I emailed the two places the image is publicly available, the Special Collection Library at the University of Vermont and the Vermont Historical Society. Neither had identifying information. So, this fight over who is in a photograph on the wall of a museum exhibit in Burlington, it's a microcosm of this controversy playing out around Vermont and beyond, and it illustrates a lot of the tensions and frustrations baked into this situation. Emotions are high. People are upset. Because this is really a fight over whether Vermont and its state-recognized tribes should decide who is Abenaki. And Odinak and Wolinak First Nations, federally recognized tribes in Canada, don't think they should. This is a dispute that goes back at least two decades, but it didn't really come into public view until 2022 at an event held at the University of Vermont.
I wanted to acknowledge friends of Odinak that came here today.
It was a symposium sponsored by UVM's History Department, described as featuring, quote, unheard Abenaki voices from the Odinak First Nation. At that event, Abenaki citizens who belonged to Odinak First Nation in Canada came to Vermont and said that the state-recognized tribes here are made up of people who aren't really Abenaki.
They sell fake native arts jewelry, and they write books, they do conferences, they use the fishing and hunting rights that are treaty rights meant for real Abenaki. They distort our culture and language beyond recognition. They are erasing us by replacing us.
Members and allies of Vermont's state-recognized tribes said these accusations hurt.
I'm getting calls because we've got kids at UVM, Abenakis who are at UVM, and the concern is, are we safe at the University of Vermont? Because if they weren't actually at this event, they hurt. And they heard that the way the American Abenaki, the Vermont Abenaki, were castigated.
The UVM event was the first time I, and many others, heard the sentiment shared so directly and publicly. But I'd heard whispers about this ever since starting to report agriculture stories for Vermont Public a few years ago. As soon as I started building relationships with sources involved in Indigenous issues, this question of legitimacy came up. And I'll just say here, I'm not Indigenous, but I have been the primary person reporting on this story in our newsroom. And through this reporting, we have learned from a number of Indigenous sources and experts that being Indigenous is different from other forms of identity, such as race or gender. While there's not a universally agreed upon definition of what it means to be Indigenous, one common understanding is that it is a political identity. Basically, that you're a citizen of an Indigenous nation in addition to being a citizen of the U.S. or Canada, and that it is up to each Indigenous nation to collectively determine who belongs and who does not. But this gets complicated when it comes to Vermont's state-recognized tribes, because as we're going to discuss in this story, they differ a lot from many Indigenous nations. not just because they're recognized at the state level, which is relatively uncommon, but also because of how some of their members, and even leaders, define what it means to be Indigenous.
There are all kinds of lived experiences. We are not less than here. We are different.
And that difference is central to the question of legitimacy. Not everyone thinks we should be covering this controversy. We've experienced strong pushback on the stories we've published since the UVM event in 2022.
And there's also responsible journalism. And yes, I'm looking at you, Lodi. To keep a one-sided narrative, for whatever reason that is, to just concentrate on Odinak's issue and not be responsible in the journalism for balance.
But in our reporting prior to that 2022 UVM event with Odinak citizens, we excluded both Odinak First Nation and Wolinak First Nation and their criticism of Vermont's state-recognized tribes.
For instance, you might remember this Brave Little State episode about Abenaki peoples from 2016.
What is the status of the Abenaki Native Americans in Vermont today?
We brought Bethany's question straight to some of the people who can answer it best. Abenaki
leaders. That episode focused on Vermont's state-recognized tribes and their increasing visibility.
We've been here forever, and they just recognized us.
People kept saying that there were no natives in Vermont and everything like that. And then finally it was like, ta-da, yeah, there are.
Well, the status of Abenaki peoples in Vermont today is more complicated and contentious than we've previously reported.
And some of you have been wondering about it, too.
My name is Jenny Prince, and I'm wondering what it means that the Odinak Abenaki First Nation of Quebec recently denounced all Vermont and New Hampshire tribes due to self-indigenization.
Right around the time Elodie started her reporting on this issue, we got this question from Jenny Prince.
Prince lives in the Champlain Islands, and she is not Indigenous herself.
She says she submitted this question to the show because she'd heard about this dispute, and it wasn't getting a ton of media attention at the time.
I wanted to encourage Brave Little State to talk about this because I think that within Vermont, it has been a really sensitive subject, and it hasn't been something that maybe a lot of people really welcomed. I think that Vermonters are protective of the Abenaki identity, white Vermonters, non-Abenaki Vermonters.
This conflict is connected to a long history.
We didn't travel here from somewhere else. We emerged here.
Both for Indigenous peoples and settlers.
White Americans have dressed up, played Indian over time, from the Revolution to the present day.
And it's connected to a disputed history.
For the original Vermonters, the Abenaki, eugenics and racial prejudice led to a life lived in the shadows.
We never lived in hiding. This is not something I would like the next generation to read about.
It's also related to a fundamental disconnect over what it means to be Indigenous.
I felt a sense of connection to that ancestor who gave me that sense of connection to the land.
When it moves from being about a people, a nation, a collective in defending their land and place-based rights to defending your own individual rights based on some ancestral claim, that's a total problem. And I think
part of the conflict is about whether the state of Vermont should be recognizing groups as Indigenous in the first place.
But I don't think these people were coming forward for state recognition for any reason other than that they were of Abenaki descent and wanted to preserve their culture.
This is a conflict with money and power at stake.
It's really clear to me that this is politics, and politics is about power and control.
But also the right to be viewed as an authority on your community's story.
And I've heard this over and over, we just want to honor you. Well, to honor us is to listen to us, listen to what we are saying.
This is a story for anyone who wants to understand the deeper context of this controversy, from the history to the ongoing tension. Whether you're a citizen of Odinak or Wolinak First Nations, a member of Vermont state-recognized tribes, or neither.
Welcome to Recognized, a special series from Brave Little State.
The story of Abenaki peoples is, broadly speaking, agreed upon until the year 1800 or so. In a way, that's when this dispute begins, with disputed history. But first, the word Odinak means in the village, and it's a location that has been significant to Abenaki peoples for many generations, long before the year 1800, and long before any Europeans showed up on the continent. So, let's take a trip to Odinak.
Good day. How are you, Elodie?
Better with coffee.
I met up with a reporter from New Hampshire Public Radio, Julia Furukawa, on a very cold day last winter.
I can't believe you didn't cook coffee. It's 10 degrees out.
The sound of success.
We woke up very early.
So I was technically awake at 5.
And drove to Odinak First Nations Reserve in Quebec. From the Vermont-Canada border crossing in Highgate Springs, Odinak is pretty much a 2-hour drive straight north. The reserve is right next to the Rivière Saint-François, or the St. Francis River. On that riverbank sits Quebec's first-ever Aboriginal museum institution, the Musée des Abenakis. We visit the museum with Odinak First Nations Assistant General Director, Susie Obomsawin. She leads us towards a brick building.
So this is the museum.
And she points out the museum is housed in the former Indian Day School.
It was a Catholic school. They were being taught in French, and my grandfather went there, my great-grandfather went there. They were teaching about making sure they are going to be good civilians.
In other words,
taking away their Indian identity to make sure they fit into the Canadian society.
We walk inside the former school-turned-museum, which is full of kids on a field trip. There's a giant map of the Northeast near the entrance. That's where Susie begins our tour.
So usually the tour of the museum starts with the some words related to the territory, the Ndakina.
In English, Ndakina means our territory.
So our territory used to go all the way down to what is today Boston. And of course, the Lake Champlain was part of our territory.
Lake Champlain is where Susie says all of Abenaki history begins.
And Lake Champlain is actually our birthplace, according to the creation story of the nation. We were made out of stone first, and then because it was not good enough, we were then made out of black ash. And this is why black ash is so important to us as a nation.
This creation story can give you a sense of just how long Abenaki peoples, or known by another name, Wabanaki peoples, or people of the Dawn, have been here in this place.
We didn't travel here from somewhere else. We emerged here.
This is Molly Obomsawin. She's a citizen of Odinak First Nation who studies Abenaki history.
From that time, we spent generations and generations learning how to live here in these homelands.
And Molly Obomsawin, by the way, is only distantly related to Susie Obomsawin. Obomsawin is a pretty common Abenaki last name.
We developed an incredible system of understanding the moon cycles, and there's lots of stories attached to that. And we have all our cultural heroes like Glooskap.
Molly says Glooskap is the first human and first Wabanaki.
And so Glooskap is hilarious because he just kind of goes around messing up, making mistakes and doing things like taking the easy way out and like having to learn over and over why it's important to, act with intention. He learns lessons for us so that we have something to hold on to and make reference to in the way that we live our lives.
In addition to holding lessons, Molly says Wabanaki stories can give important information about the geological time periods during which Abenaki peoples have been here.
Some of our oldest stories talk about the time when the people learned that there was going to be an ice age. We also have stories about megafauna, like giant beavers, which we also know through Western science did exist here.
Archaeological digs have also verified stories and legends about Abenaki peoples going to Odinak. Here's Susie Obomsawin again.
But with the diggings, we can actually say that that site was a site that was already known to Abenaki people before colonization, and it was for thousands of years. Having proof of that was just so much comfort. Like, now it's clear, like, we are not refugees. We knew that place before.
Prior to colonization, Abenaki peoples weren't just clustered at Odinak. They lived all throughout their territory. Back to Molly Obomsawin.
And we moved following the food, but also following and maintaining complex trade economies. And that would also be conducted through the waterways. And we knew a lot about the cultures surrounding us, our brother nations and our ally nations.
Fast forward to the early 1600s. Molly says there was some warfare among nations during a period of what was likely food scarcity. Also happening at that time,
with the arrival of Europeans, was the Great Dying.
Disease, warfare, enslavement, and slaughter. One study shows the indigenous population in the Americas declined by 90%, from 60 million people to only 6 million in the first century after the arrival of Europeans.
And that is what really started to cause a lot of the great migrations and displacements and disruptions in Wabanaki lifeways at that time.
Abenaki peoples began moving out of places like Vermont and New Hampshire and into the northern parts of their territory in modern-day Quebec. French colonists began setting up mission villages there. Among them were Odinak and Woolinak, and Molly says these would become a place of refuge for permanent settlement as well as temporary relief during colonial warfare.
At home, at Odinak and Woolinak, we are still the stewards of those homelands. We never ceded those territories, but we did take refuge from the warfare and the genocide that was targeting us. I think our ancestors decided that it was easier to stay alive on the north side of what would become the border.
This brings us to the year 1800. Odinak and Woolinak say their ancestors had left what is now Vermont and New Hampshire by then. And in the years following, they would visit and move back into southern areas of their territory and places beyond, like the Adirondacks and the Capital Region areas of New York.
And so we would travel down, and we also became economically dependent on trading with settlers, right? And we also continued to go down and visit our relatives in these various outposts that were created in that period from the 1800s and the 1900s.
Among those outposts was Thompson's Point in Charlotte, Vermont. A 1954 newspaper article in the Burlington Free Press says seven or eight Abenaki families were living in tents at the turn of the 20th century. Among them were brother and sister William and Marion Obomsawin. There's that name again. Their father, the newspaper article said, initially paddled to the spot by canoe and later brought his kids from Canada after he built a house. Nearly 50 years later, the Free Press story said the Obomsawins were the last living Abenakis at Thompson's Point. Recordings that an anthropologist made of the Obomsawins in 1956 are kept in Dartmouth College's Rauner Special Collections Library. That's in Hanover, New Hampshire. Molly Obomsawin recently studied for a research residency there, and she brought me one day this past spring.
You're with me, so you're
inside the library, I ask Molly to play a recording of William Obomsawin.
Hopefully it won't be too disruptive.
We're including it here with permission from Odinak First Nation. In it, William Obomsawin repeats a story passed down over many generations.
Charmant Bay, where the British tried to cross the lake there, where the British landed down there.
Is that Shelburne Point?
Shelburne Point, yeah.
Pause it for a second. What he's talking about is like the American Revolution, right? And when there started to be all this action in the area around Lake Champlain, where we were currently living at the time, right?
As we listen to archival recordings, Molly and I are sitting at a desk surrounded by giant boxes of papers kept by Gordon Day. Day was a non-Indigenous anthropologist known for doing in-depth study of Abenaki peoples. And Molly is looking for something.
I'm just looking for a specific thing. It's in the 70s.
The 1970s, when this historical narrative we've talked about so far is challenged. For the first time, members of what would become Vermont's state-recognized tribes started saying that, in fact, whole communities of Abenaki peoples stayed behind in Vermont and New Hampshire after 1800.
And he starts getting letters from his friend who's a attorney, and the attorney is like, please give me information on
what's happening in Swanton. Who are these people?
What was happening in Swanton? That's when we come back. The story for centuries was that Abenaki peoples fled north across the Canadian border to the reserves in Quebec. Then from there, they occasionally visited or moved back to more southern outposts. But in the 1970s, you start hearing that Abenaki peoples actually stayed south of the Canadian border the whole time, secretly living among the white settlers that surrounded them. This version of history, it took hold thanks in large part to a man named Homer St. Francis.
Today I'm not in a very good mood because I got a word that they even shot down our ABE grant because they're afraid the Abenaki's getting too educated for them.
Here St. Francis is speaking at the since-closed Burlington College in 1989. He's talking about how the state of Vermont is marginalizing its original inhabitants.
They don't want them to have a high school diploma or a GED or anything else. They want to force them into the slave market for this country. Well, they're not going in the slave market for this country. We will survive. We survived for 1,000 years, and we will survive again.
Homer St. Francis is a big reason why we're talking about Abenaki peoples in Vermont at all. He was really good at saying things that made people take notice.
As the people of this so-called state are fed up with this bureaucratic bullshit.
His name began popping up in newspaper articles in the mid-1970s as part of a group in the Swanton-Highgate area of northwestern Vermont. The group was saying they were Abenaki, that they had always been in Vermont, and that they, therefore, had rights to land as well as free hunting and fishing. This was happening at the same time as the nationwide Red Power movement. Indigenous peoples all over the country were fighting for the federal government to honor treaties promising sovereignty and land and water rights.
Hundreds of American Indians marched on the Capitol today. They are part of the Longest Walk, a 3,000-mile march from west to east coast, and they are protesting what they call anti-Indian sentiment in Congress. Karen Chagrou of station WAMU was there as the...
In Vermont, Homer St. Francis didn't just align the fight for Indigenous sovereignty with a nationwide movement. He also aligned his cause with that of other marginalized people around the state.
I have calls every day from poor people and poor farmers, and they're right up in arms.
Here he is again at that 1989 event.
You got to stay together as a group. Strength is in numbers. So, like I said, if I have to, I'll start a whole new society here. I'm not afraid to adopt them into the tribe if need be.
The, quote, tribe St. Francis is talking about had many names, including the St. Francis Sokoke Band of Abenakis of Vermont. We're going to call it the St. Francis Sokoke Band for short. Homer St. Francis acted as the chief of the St. Francis Sokoke Band for a total of 15 years. Not without controversy. Shortly after this group first became visible in northwestern Vermont, the anthropologist Gordon Day, as well as Swanton residents, cast doubt on St. Francis's claims that he and hundreds of others were in fact Abenaki. In a 1976 article in the Rutland Herald, the Swanton police chief said that he, quote, never even knew there were any Indians in the town until about 6 months ago. Pretty soon, factions emerged within the St. Francis Sokoke Band itself, leading to splinter groups. One of those splinter groups accused Homer St. Francis of being, among other things, quote, power hungry.
He was a lot of things, you know, and he was a lot of things. But when Homer was on his game and he hadn't been drinking, Homer was brilliant.
This is Jeff Benet. He is not Indigenous and has never claimed to be. But he got involved with the St. Francis Sokoke Band in the late 1970s as the director of Indian education for the local school district. He knew Homer St. Francis well. He says that some people saw St. Francis as a bully. But according to Benet, that was all part of St. Francis's strategy to raise the profile of the St. Francis Sokoke Band through acts of civil disobedience and generating publicity to get into newspapers.
He made these statements, and the major one was that we'll be taking over Swanton, and people would be absolutely ripped. What do you mean taking over? Like our houses?
And, you know, it was a wink and a nod, but he said, well, sure. You know, and did people get upset with that? Absolutely.
In addition to the threat of taking over Swanton, St. Francis led multiple protests to fight for free fishing licenses. He also encouraged St. Francis Okokie Band members to stop using state license plates. And he tried to convince the federal government to leave the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge and pay $100 million in back rent. They did not. But St. Francis's forceful advocacy did lead to some gains for his community. A 1986 article in the Rutland Herald, Vermont Sunday Magazine, credits Jeff Binet's work as the director of Indian education with reducing dropout rates in Franklin County schools. St. Francis also founded the Abenaki Self-Help Association, which that Sunday Magazine article says was helping people get their GEDs and distributing food to community members in need. Something else that the St. Francis Okokie Band fought for was official recognition from both the state and federal governments. They got state recognition ever so briefly in 1976, but it was quickly revoked. As for federal recognition, in 1980, St. Francis sent to the federal government a letter of intent stating their plans to file a petition for federal acknowledgement as an Indigenous nation. Remember that petition, because it's going to play an important role in this story. North of the border, leaders of Odinak and Woolinak First Nations were initially supportive of the St. Francis Okokie Band. They even issued resolutions recognizing the band in 1976 and 1977. And there's evidence of Odinak and Woolinak First Nations support of the self-proclaimed Vermont Abenaki as recently as 1999. There are numerous stories, too, about cultural exchange between Odinak First Nation and the self-proclaimed Vermont Abenaki. From language classes to dance groups to basket making. Here's Bonita Lenga, a member of one of the present-day Vermont state-recognized tribes, speaking at a press conference this past spring.
I then went on to join the Wabanaki dancers as a teenager.
Lenga is talking about participating in a group that learned traditional dances from an Odinak teacher in the late 1990s.
Where we would meet for monthly rehearsals in a potluck in Burlington, Vermont. We did many performances, I'm sure, over the
And here's Fred Wiseman, another member of Vermont state-recognized tribes, speaking earlier this year to Odinak officials at a meeting of the Vermont Commission on Native American Affairs.
Yeah, you can remember the old days when I was up at Odinak a lot, teaching, helping, working with you.
Wiseman also recalls the time when these relationships began to cool off.
But after 2003, except for occasionally, I did not feel all that welcome. I did not feel all that safe like we had when we were all working together.
My community has always been a pretty open community, and you know that, okay?
Yeah, maybe I overstated. Not safe, but not welcome anymore. Do you think I'd love to come up?
2003. This year being talked about here was a big pivot point. It's when Odinak First Nation changed course and began denouncing non-federally recognized groups claiming to be Abenaki, like the St. Francis Okokie Band in Vermont. It's also around this time that Odinak citizens began asking people in the St. Francis Okokie Band who their relatives were. That's according to Jacques Watzo, an elected official at Odinak.
But when we started asking questions, where are you from, which family, then that's when they raised a lot of red flags in Odinak, and they stopped coming to Odinak because we were trying to hold them accountable.
Essentially, Odinak officials say they realized that members of the St. Francis Okokie Band couldn't produce genealogical documentation proving they were related to other Abenaki citizens, documentation that Odinak requires of its own citizens. Also, something else happened just 10 months prior that further called into question the St. Francis Okokie Band's legitimacy. Remember the petition for federal acknowledgement that the St. Francis Okokie Band started filing in 1980? Well, 2 decades later, in 2002, they still hadn't received an official determination. Homer St. Francis, who submitted the first piece of paper for this petition, was no longer alive. But it's at this time, in 2002, that the St. Francis Okokie Band did receive a response to their petition for federal acknowledgement from the Vermont government, specifically the Vermont Attorney General's office. Eve Jacobs-Carnahan was the author of this response. She was a special assistant attorney general at the time, and she's not Indigenous.
Bill Griffin, the chief assistant attorney general, came to me and said, "Hey, I have a project for you. We don't really know anything about federal acknowledgement of petitions, but you're a good researcher. This might be fun." I don't think any of us had any idea where it was going to lead.
In 2003, Chief Assistant Attorney General Bill Griffin told the newspaper 7 Days that more and more Vermont lawmakers were coming to him, asking about the merits of the state recognizing the self-proclaimed Vermont Abenaki. That's what he said led to doing the report. The Vermont AG published this 244-page document in December 2002, and it wasn't focused on the merits of state recognition. Instead, Eve Jacobs-Carnahan's research and write-up was geared specifically towards the federal acknowledgement process, like whether the St. Francis Okoki Band's petition did or did not fulfill the requirements outlined by the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs. The report argued it did not. Here's a colleague reading from the conclusion.
"The evidence raises serious questions about the existence of a tribe of Abenakis in Vermont who are a continuation of the historic Abenakis who lived at Missisquoi prior to the American Revolution. The invisibility of any tribe from 1790 to 1974 was so complete that historians, anthropologists, and census takers were unable to locate it. No outside observers verify its existence during that time period."
The AG's office also did not find sufficient proof that Homer St. Francis and the other members of the St. Francis Okoki Band had Abenaki ancestry. This caused quite a ripple around the state. Local scholars who worked with and wrote about the self-proclaimed Vermont Abenaki called the report a, quote, hatchet job in the press. One open question was whether the AG's office had a vested interest in the St. Francis Okoki Band failing in their bid for federal recognition. See, recognizing an Indigenous nation means making amends and acknowledging rights. It's not the type of thing governments are known to do readily. Bill Griffin, the chief assistant attorney general in Vermont at the time, told 7 Days that legally recognizing the self-proclaimed Vermont Abenaki as an Indigenous nation would have consequences, and that it would be like, quote, creating another state within Vermont. But the AG's office also maintained that they wrote the response to the St. Francis Okoki Band's petition with no other motivation apart from participating in the process. Vermont's not the only state to submit a response to a petition for federal acknowledgement, but it does seem pretty rare. None of the 5 most recent decisions on petitions for federal acknowledgement mention input from state attorneys general. There are more than 1,200 federally recognized Indigenous nations in the U.S. and Canada. Both countries have different processes in place, but broadly, what they are recognizing is that these Indigenous nations have long and continuous relationships with their homelands. And they have inherent rights, as well as a political relationship with colonial governments. That political relationship is, or is supposed to be, government to government. In other words, Indigenous nations are self-governing, sovereign entities.
Sovereignty doesn't mean a whole lot if outsiders don't acknowledge it.
This is Matthew Fletcher, professor of law and American culture at the University of Michigan. He's a citizen of the federally recognized Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. One of his areas of expertise is U.S. federal Indian law.
Tribes that are not federally acknowledged, they certainly can assert sovereignty over their own citizens and probably aspects of their own lands. But a lot of that is kind of meaningless unless the United States government acknowledges that sovereignty. And if the United States does, then state governments have to as well.
Indigenous nations that are federally recognized govern their own citizens and do things like make and enforce laws and create their own taxes. They also become eligible for certain funding and programs guaranteed in exchange for the land and resources these Indigenous nations gave up to the U.S.
That duty of protection, that trust responsibility requires the United States to guarantee health, housing, law enforcement, public safety, education, all sorts of things, everything that a government does. And if you don't have federal acknowledgement, the United States government will not provide those services.
So that's the sort of recognition the 1,200-member St. Francis Okoki Band was looking for starting in the 1980s. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, or BIA, then assessed the application for nearly three decades. This timeline is actually not unusual. The federal recognition process is infamously arduous. The Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians of Montana, for instance, spent nearly 42 years in the BIA process before getting federal recognition through an act of U.S. Congress in late 2019. And some longstanding communities who have at times had treaties with the U.S. government are still not recognized, like the Chinook Indian Nation in Washington, which has been seeking federal recognition for 120 years.
The factors that you need to fulfill the actual test that the United States puts forward are unbelievably expensive. You have to hire expert witnesses. You have to dredge up every conceivable document, going back as far as possible for the history of the tribe.
Matthew Fletcher calls the BIA federal acknowledgement process, quote, relentlessly bureaucratic and Kafkaesque.
It's ridiculous that the level of unfair scrutiny that these bureaucrats put forth on these tribes.
But Dan Levren says the process isn't supposed to be easy. He's also a professor with expertise in U.S. federal Indian law.
Federal acknowledgement is a very meaningful and solemn thing. It is saying that the United States government is going to have a relationship, a government-to-government relationship with another entity.
Leverance is a citizen of the federally recognized Iowa tribe of Kansas and Nebraska and currently teaches at the University of North Dakota. Between 2015 and 2017, he actually worked for the U.S. Department of Interior, providing legal advice to the BIA office that reviews petitions for federal acknowledgement.
The people at Interior would say that part of their job is to make sure that groups who should be acknowledged are, but part of their job is to make sure that groups that shouldn't be acknowledged aren't.
When the BIA finally released its proposed finding in 2005 and its final decision in 2007, both reports said no. The St. Francis Okoki Band did not have enough evidence to make its case. The BIA's conclusions mirrored what the Vermont Attorney General's office had written several years earlier in the state's response. Both essentially say, there's just no proof that the St. Francis Okoki Band of Abenakis of Vermont existed prior to the 1970s. And there's just not enough evidence that group members are descended from Abenaki ancestors. On that last note, the BIA pointed out that less than 1% of the St. Francis Okoki Band's 1,200 members could demonstrate descent from an Abenaki ancestor or, quote, any other historical Indian tribe. For the eight members whom the BIA could trace to an Abenaki ancestor, they did so through historical lists that Odinak First Nation has kept of its citizens. The BIA described the St. Francis Okoki Band as, quote,
a collection of individuals of claimed but mostly undemonstrated Indian ancestry with little or no social or historical connection with each other before the early 1970s.
Therefore, the BIA determined the band should not get the federal benefits set aside for this land's original indigenous peoples. In response to the BIA's findings, the then leader of the St. Francis Okoki Band, April Rushlow Merrill, pointed out that the group did at least satisfy three of seven BIA criteria. Both the legal experts I talked to, Matthew Fletcher and Dan Leverance, agree that it's harder for Indigenous peoples in the eastern part of the United States than it is for those in the western U.S. to produce the required documentation for federal recognition. That's because colonizing countries like England, France, and the Netherlands didn't have the same formalized agreements with Eastern Indigenous peoples that the United States later made with Western Indigenous peoples. But Levren says there are plenty of Eastern Indigenous nations who have managed to produce enough documentation to be federally acknowledged, even if their communities had longer to contend with the violence, displacement, assimilation, and family separation enacted by the settlers surrounding them.
So the most recent administrative acknowledgement was Pamunkey in 2016, which is Virginia. Before that was Shinnecock in New York in 2010. Before that, Mashpee in Massachusetts in 2007. And you have other Northeastern tribes, Mohegan from Connecticut, the Wampanoag of Gayhead, which is now Aquinna in Massachusetts, Narragansetts in Rhode Island.
And compared to the St. Francis of Cokey Band's application, which could only demonstrate that less than 1% of their membership descended from Abenaki ancestors, those Eastern acknowledged indigenous nations could show all or nearly all of their membership descended from a historical indigenous community. In the case of the St. Francis of Cokey Band's petition for federal acknowledgement, what stands out to me from both the federal and Vermont government's responses is that neither deny there were Abenaki peoples present in the state of Vermont between the turn of the 19th century and the 1970s. In fact, they confirm through newspaper articles, historical journals, and notes from anthropologist Gordon Day that Abenaki peoples were visible here at various times. Instead, what the BIA and the Vermont Attorney General's Office claim is that they couldn't find similar documentation showing there were distinct Abenaki peoples in Vermont, separate from Odinak and Wolinak First Nations. At least, not from the materials submitted in the St. Francis of Cokey Band's petition for federal acknowledgement. There is a theory out there about how that could have been. How there could have been a distinct Abenaki community in Vermont for so long without leaving behind a paper trail. I tried to trace this theory back, and I ended up at the research of two men. First up, a man named John Moody. He acted as the St. Francis of Cokey Band's researcher for their petition for federal acknowledgement. And by the way, I asked Moody via email whether he claims to be Abenaki. He declined to answer this question. You'll remember that, for a long time, the story was that by 1800 or so, Abenaki peoples fled Vermont and other southern parts of their territory to survive the devastation of colonization, and moved north to settle in Canada. But John Moody theorized that some Abenaki peoples never left Vermont. Instead, he argued they avoided persecution by living in secrecy. Moody shared his theory in a 1980 interview with the Burlington Free Press. According to the article, Moody arrived at this theory by taping oral histories with members of the St. Francis of Cokey Band. He said that people shared, quote, traditional Indian skills, like the use of herbs, that, quote, were identical to those of the Abenakis and Odinak. Moody would not share these oral histories when I asked. Moody also said in that article that he looked through government and church records. He concluded there were names of Abenaki peoples who were supposed to have left Vermont for the Canadian reserves by 1800, but were missing from records in Canada. Moody's theory that some Abenaki peoples stayed in Vermont and lived in secrecy took hold. The reports published by the Vermont Attorney General's Office and the Bureau of Indian Affairs document how Moody influenced late 20th century historians and the books they wrote about Abenaki peoples. The BIA, for its part, called Moody's work, quote, highly speculative and not reliable. I asked John Moody to share documentation confirming his research. He declined, and he also did not want to speak on the record. The question now arises, why would Abenaki peoples hide in Vermont for close to two centuries? According to Matthew Fletcher, the University of Michigan law professor, colonization put massive pressure on indigenous communities to assimilate. But in this state, there's another explanation people have often pointed to. It has to do with something from the 1920s and 30s called the Eugenic Survey of Vermont.
I mean, my grandmother was on the survey. She changed her name three times because she was trying to avert the survey. She died in the 90s. I mean, you know, it's not that far away. So there's still a lot of people that don't want to be on a list, if you know what I mean.
The Eugenic Survey of Vermont was a study that lasted from 1925 to 1936. It was organized by University of Vermont zoology professor Henry Perkins. According to a history from UVM itself, the study aimed to reduce growth in the population of Vermont's, quote, social problem group. Perkins also advocated heavily for a state sterilization law that went into effect in 1931. Eugenics, broadly speaking, was a theory that some people are better than others, and that you should segregate or sterilize the less desirable parts of the population. It is an awful pseudoscientific theory, and it's something that shaped public policy in Vermont throughout the 20th century.
It would probably be easier to list the number of Vermont leaders that were against it than those who were for it.
This is Mercedes de Guardiola, a historian who just published a new book titled Vermont for the Vermonters, A History of Eugenics in the Green Mountain State. She declined to be interviewed for this story, but she spoke with Vermont Public in 2021, and that's the tape you're hearing.
It's so tied into policies behind social welfare, thinking behind how you provide aid to certain members of the community, how you treat people in institutions.
The eugenics survey lasted from the 1920s to the 1930s. But it wasn't until 1991 that Kevin Dan wrote an article linking the survey to Abenaki peoples in Vermont. Dan is a non-Indigenous historian and contemporary of John Moody. Remember, he's the researcher who said that Abenaki peoples were living in Vermont in secret to avoid persecution. We know from public documents that Dan and Moody were corresponding with one another and sharing ideas. Ideas like John Moody saying that Abenaki peoples who remained in Vermont post-1800 were living as, quote, gypsies. Gypsy is now seen as a pejorative term for Romani people. We're using it here because it appears in the documents we're citing. And Kevin Dan appears to have taken John Moody's claim about, quote, gypsies one step further. In his 1991 article, Dan wrote that among the families studied in the Eugenics Survey of Vermont for their, quote, degeneracy, there were the, quote, gypsies. And Dan said they were primarily of Abenaki and French-Canadian ancestry. Dan did not cite a source for this conclusion in his article. But regardless, this narrative caught on. The Abenaki peoples were studied and targeted by the Eugenics Survey of Vermont. It was repeated and alluded to in newspaper articles, books, and more recently, in 2019 and 2021, by the University of Vermont and the Vermont Legislature, in public apologies for the impact of the Eugenics Survey and related state policies. And even Vermont Public has been among the news outlets to continue repeating this narrative on this podcast and in other stories.
For the original Vermonters, the Abenaki, eugenics and racial prejudice led to a life lived in the shadows, where their ancestry was hidden instead of celebrated.
This was a very dark chapter in Vermont's history. It involved coerced sterilization of the Abenaki, also French Canadians, poor people, disabled people.
It turns out the truth about Abenaki peoples and the Eugenics Survey of Vermont is far less certain. I called up Kevin Dan to discuss the origins of his 1991 article. And just a heads up, the audio quality here isn't great.
Can you just tell me a little bit about how you got on this path to going through the records and researching the eugenics survey?
It was the laundry building for the state hospital that had been turned into the records center.
Dan went through these cardboard boxes at the Waterbury complex that now houses a bunch of state offices.
And so it had all that atmosphere of, you know, real darkness about it.
Among the records, Dan said he recognized names of Abenaki families. But those family names weren't from the St. Francis Sokoke Band. They were names that Dan recognized from anthropologist Gordon Day, who studied Odinak First Nation. But that distinction, that the names were related to Odinak, did not make it into the public presentation of Dan's findings.
All of a sudden it became a Homer St. Francis standing there in front of journalists and waving some, I don't even think I had published anything at that point. It might have been a manuscript thing and said, look, there was this Abenaki Holocaust. I mean, that blew my mind. I felt very much that, you know, if there had been anything like that, I would have found some evidence of it. And I didn't.
What Kevin Dan told me, it calls into question the whole theory that the eugenics survey targeted a distinct community of Abenaki peoples in Vermont, It does not mean that people associated with the St. Francis Sokoke Band and the state-recognized tribes today weren't also impacted by eugenics. There is public documentation showing ancestors of the self-proclaimed Vermont Abenaki were studied in the Eugenics Survey of Vermont. And that public documentation does refer to some of those ancestors as, quote, Indian. What there doesn't appear to be outright evidence for, however, is that these ancestors were targeted because they were Abenaki. That's what the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Vermont Attorney General's Office also concluded from the materials provided as part of the St. Francis Sokoke Band's petition for federal acknowledgement. And Odinak First Nation officials say this too.
We never said nobody from those groups went through those traumas. Maybe they went through those traumas, but not because they were Abenaki.
Susie Obomsawin from Odinak First Nation says that Abenaki peoples being targeted by eugenics policies is just not something Odinak citizens ever heard about from their relatives visiting and living in Vermont.
But they never said anything related to eugenic practice. Like, not even one person.
Obomsawin says there are traumas that Odinak First Nation has experienced, like the traumas of residential schools. But
there are traumas that we didn't have. We don't need more, because we never lived in hiding. So this is not something I would like the next generation to read about. This is not what happened. Our ancestor did not hide.
Just to recap, the self-proclaimed Vermont Abenaki started seeking federal recognition in 1980. And there were a number of setbacks along the way, like the report from the Vermont AG's office in 2002, and a few years later when the Bureau of Indian Affairs officially rejected their petition. But the self-proclaimed Vermont Abenaki kept pushing, now shifting their focus to state recognition. And they found support from a really important group, state lawmakers.
Reporter Elodie Reed. Coming up on tomorrow's Vermont edition, we share the rest of Recognized, a special series from Brave Little State. It's about Abenaki peoples and the ongoing dispute about who belongs to their communities. You can also listen to the full series in the Brave Little State podcast feed or at our main website, vermontpublic.org. Recognized was reported by Elodie Reed. It was produced and edited by Josh Crane, Sabine Pooks, Angela Evansy, and many others. You can find a full list of contributors at our website, vermontpublic.org. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.